Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome and thanks for joining us at the podcast today. I just spoke with Linda Roy Fung about her new book, City of Marvel and Transformation, Chang'an and Narratives of Experience in Tang Dynasty China. This came out in 2015 with the University of Hawaii Press. Now, this is a book that's very much full of marvels and full of transformations. It takes us into Tang Dynasty China and introduces us and really reintroduces us in a very new way to the city capital of Chang'an. Now, this was a space that was being remade and transformed in this period, thanks in part to a new way of construing the civil examination system that had candidates coming to the capital every single year to take the exam. Now, what that did is it transformed, as she shows, what travel was. It transformed the selfhoods, the experiences of time and space of these candidates that would come to the capital and experience and help make the city. It also transformed narratives of time and space and self and pleasure and desire and information in really fascinating ways. So the interview is fairly extensive, so I'll let you get to that in a moment. But what I want to do first is read to you from one page of Linda's book. It's a very beautifully written book. And I want to read to you the brief description of one of the tales that comes up in a lot of the chapters, almost all of the chapters, if not all of them, that we refer to repeatedly but don't talk too much about. And this is the tale of Li Hua. So I'm going to just read to you from page 17 of the introduction so that you know what this tale is about and kind of what the deal is before you listen to it so that you can situate the conversation within this. So here goes, and this is Linda's words in the introduction of the book. This tale begins as a promising young tribute scholar, Zheng, leaves home for Chang'an. Once there, he becomes smitten with the eponymous, this is Li Hua, right? The eponymous courtesan moves in with her and depletes his fortune after 2 years. He's abandoned by Li Hua and her madam, but recovers from sickness and poverty by becoming a dirge singer with a funeral parlor, eventually winning a citywide singing competition. From this height, however, he plunges again. His father discovers his son's disgraceful livelihood and beats him nearly to death. Sinking to the nadir of his existence, the young man succumbs to begging on the streets of Chang'an. Before long, he's discovered in this state and is rescued by the selfsame Li Hua, who nurses him back to physical and spiritual health. He then successfully obtains his degree and embarks on an illustrious official career while Li Hua ultimately assumes the role of his virtuous wife. Now, this is one of many, many stories that you are introduced to as a reader of this book. It's really just a fascinating foray into the narrative worlds of stories and storytelling in Chang'an. And with that, so now that you understand, hopefully, what the whole shape of the Li Hua story is all about, I will leave you to the fabulous Linda talking about her fabulous book. But first, thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening. And I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk to Linda Roy Fung about her new book, City of Marvel and Transformation, Chang'an and Narratives of Experience in Tang Dynasty China. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Linda. Thanks for making time. Thanks for writing a beautiful book that's visually beautiful as well as narratively beautiful. And I'm really looking forward to talking to you today.
Thank you, Carla. And I just want to say I'm an enthusiastic listener of your podcast, and it has been a wonderful experience for me to be involved with this conversation.
Hey, well, thank you. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. So, Linda, let's get started, as is traditional for the channel, by talking a little bit about how you came to the field and specifically what brought you to work on Tang China.
So I will preface my answer by saying that this, what I'm about to say only makes sense in retrospect, because as we move through our studies, often we are just kind of, I know in my case, I'm just always searching and looking, and it doesn't make sense. The whole process doesn't really make sense until it's finished. So I'll start by saying, as an undergrad, there was a couple of moments that brought me to the field, and probably one of the most important. I was a geochemistry major. I was studying geochemistry. My undergraduate thesis advisor, Dick Holland, had brought us to Canada for a field trip, a research field trip. And one of the most memorable moments I know from this trip was I'm not used to these trips where we look at the geological formations, some of the oldest geological formations in North America, really. And Dick Holland had this habit of stopping us on the side of the road with some kind of outcrop. And he would kind of fold his hands, turn to us and say and ask us this question, which is, so what's the story here? he never asked, you know, tell us about the stratigraphy of this formation, you know, explain the geological forces. No, he never did that. So he actually just said, what's the story here? I didn't know it at the time, but it was kind of his question that really opened up this kind of skylight in my intellectual world, because I had been very set on being a scientist as an undergrad. I had come from a family of engineers, right? English was not my first language. And even though I could speak it more or less fluently, I didn't feel that I could do things with language and with literature using English. So Dick Holland's question got me, again, this is only in retrospect that I realized this, got me thinking about the importance of stories in not just, as storytelling per se, but in many other aspects of our lives, including the scientific. To make a long story short, years later, I was in grad school. And I had come to begin to think about doing a longer term project. And to answer the question how I had come to study Tang narratives, I had started reading these stories, I, for lack of a better term, that really just got me excited. In the sense that they were short, and yet they were let me just give you a particular example. Sure. There's the one story that stuck out in my mind was a story about a knight errant, a female knight errant, from one of the late Tang collections that I talk about in my book, there's a certain kind of playfulness in that story that made me think that stories like this could not really be reduced to any kind of universals or moral sort of concepts that are sort of easily categorized. To make a long story short, a combination of a geochemistry mentor who had got me thinking about the importance of stories, and then later readings in grad school really turned me on to this path. It's a very circuitous path, but that's the way it often happens.
Perfect. And listeners may or may not be aware that you are also a writer of really gorgeous, fabulous, fascinating fiction. So we won't talk about that in the details today, but I'll just I just want to mark that and just say how amazing it is for me to talk with you about that, because it's just always such a pleasure to talk with somebody who embodies the craft of writing and sort of the beauty of that craft here in so many different ways. And it really comes out in the writing of the book as well. So check out her fiction as well.
Thank you so much, Carla.
So the book that we're talking about today is concerned with Chang'an, and it's concerned with Chang'an as what you call a lived space. And so in the book, you call this a lived space that shaped aspirations and the production of text. You take us into narratives, including, and like the narrative that you just mentioned, that look at a series of different really interesting issues. And I'll just name some of them. And this is using largely using the words of the book. You look at the role of the literatus as wayfarer. So travel is quite an important theme here. You look at the interplay between literary prowess and sexual license. There's a whole chapter on pleasure quarters that we'll talk about. And also, you look at the possibilities for finding value and valuation outside of the normal channels, outside of the normal hierarchy. So there's a lot of work that these stories are doing to produce Chang'an as a lived space and to help us understand the way Chang'an as a lived space helped produce selves, produced individuals, produced time, and ways of experiencing and making time as well as producing space. So Linda, how did you come to focus on this? And if you could say a little bit about how that focus shifted when you moved from focusing on this as a dissertation level project to then turning to transforming this city of transformations into a book monograph.
Yes. And so again, this is one of those processes that only makes sense in retrospect, right? Because as we struggle through it or make our effort in real time, we often don't have that sort of overall Google view of what we're doing. So like I said, I had come to Tang narratives through just kind of the serendipitous realization that there are a lot of things about these narratives that are unruly in a wonderful way, and that really requires thinking outside of what we think of as traditional bibliographic formats. So my original dissertation was on the transformation process, the coming of age of literati writers. And it had been initially focused on this story called the story of the tale of Li Hua, mm-hmm. which I treat in the book, because in a way this is a story that embodies many of those stages of this coming of age process. We have a young man who is coming from the provinces into the capital, so from the peripheries into the center of the empire, and to participate in this really unprecedented event, institution of recruitment that up until now that during the Tang was really in the process of understanding itself, in the process of forming itself and having names and having procedures. So we have this young man coming into the capital for this reason, and he immediately gets lost in this in the city and in the urban space. And so this is a story, as some of the listeners might already know who are familiar with the story, but it's a sort of roughly we can think of it as a being lost in the city and then becoming found, the story of being lost and found. So my dissertation was structured around this process of getting orienting oneself, of elevating oneself through the process of passing the civil service examination, in order to be ordained as a eligible statesman, to be eligible to participate in the empire's bureaucracy, in the process of, to answer your question about what happened between the dissertation and the monograph, as I finished the dissertation, I realized that although I could still maintain this structure of this coming of age through these narrative texts, what really kind of began to grow inexorably in the dissertation was this one particular chapter about Chang'an as a city, as a space, in which all these processes of coming of age, of transformation, of legitimation were unfolding. So as this chapter grew and sort of wanted to claim more attention, I began to think of sort of reorienting the argument of what would be the future monograph in terms of Chang'an as a space. So in doing so, I had to accommodate some of the other material within Chang'an itself, but that, because the material is so rich and so multifaceted and takes on so many forms and genres, it really was not a very difficult thing to do. So Chang'an was, in a way, Chang'an as it was lived in the Tang is capacious enough to allow probably more than one dissertation to be contained within it. And so eventually this was the path that I started on.
Fabulous. Thank you. Well, let's keep going down that path and actually get into the heart and the guts of the book. So the book itself, I'll just mention for listeners, it's based on a very widely interdisciplinary approach. And in the introduction, listeners will find discussions of some of the major theoretical touchstones of the book, including Lefebvre on space, Desserteaux on everyday practices, Victor Turner on the liminal, and they'll also find a discussion of lots of the really interesting sources that were brought to bear in the making of the book, including letters and poems and epitaphs and narratives and in all sorts of different collections, anecdotes. The tale of Li Hua, as you just mentioned, also plays a really important role here. Now, the larger context of these narratives, or one important part, rather, of the larger context of these narratives is also laid out in the introduction, and that's the context of the examination system. You call Chang'an you say that it became a space of dislocation and relocation, kind of similar to what you've just been describing, in the Tang Dynasty, largely because of the examination system. There was a kind of symbiosis, to borrow a scientific metaphor that I think both of our backgrounds, I think we both started in sciences, but the symbiosis between the exam system and the urban center in the Tang. And this is a period where annual exams were held in the capital. This was new, and this was really important because examinees had to come live in the capital and travel to the capital. This happened every year. And so this really reshaped not only their experience of time and space, the way they were helping to make the space of the capital, but also their experiences and transformations of themselves. So this brings us really into the first chapter. Now, the first chapter looks at the second half of the Tang and the way that social and intellectual structures were really changing in the second half of the Tang. Now, these helped produce literati, identities that were, in your words, capable of advancement and transformation. So this chapter explores the question, how did a man of letters become a man in full? Now, the chapter argues that the recruitment mechanism of Chang'an, the sort of examination system that's part of this, helped create, as you put it, a new period of social indeterminacy and a changing concept of the literati self that we find in Tang stories. Okay, so I've just laid the foundation.
Thank you.
So one of the really interesting things that's happening in this chapter around these phenomena in this context I've just described is a changing way of creating and conceiving the name, right? The Ming.
Ming, yeah.
So can you talk a little bit about that? What's happening here that's important for you and for us to understand about the story around Ming and about selfhood and reputation?
And thank you for that wonderful summary. So to go back to this institution of examinations, the civil service examinations, of course, your question about Ming and indeterminacy and all these changes that are taking place during this time is kind of bound up in this relatively new institution of recruitment. And we know that there have been wonderful work done on the history of the examination system, and especially toward the later imperial eras. What I wanted to highlight is the fact that during the Tang, even though we had as far back as the Han, there had been avenues for advancement for men of letters through recommendation and also through a sort of an earlier version of civil service recruitment. Nothing has come out of that at the scale and at the kind of at the qualitative and quantitative level that we're seeing in the Tang, which is to say, for the first time, there is this regularized, routinized, and relatively highly publicized avenue for theoretically for men of letters to participate in the bureaucracy and to become a statesman to serve as officials by virtue of, again, this is theoretical, by virtue of having mastered literature and a number of other curricula. And if you think about it, what this institution of examination we know that this has been a very durable institution in throughout Chinese history. It had lasted until the early 20th century. Within this long, long history, the kind of things that we think of or that we associate with the system, including the name Keju, are actually had evolved after the Tang. So the Tang was occupies this peculiar prehistory in this long history of recruitment, in that there are many things about the Tang recruitment system that would have become unrecognizable or just plain weird to later eras. I sometimes think about this and I think, this period during which a young man has finished his studies and like the protagonist in the Tale of Yua has finished his studies and has, you know, arrived in the capital ready to take the examination. This period of what I'm calling the liminal state, the period of social indeterminacy, there's actually no parallel. I can't really think of good parallel in our life, in modern life. We can say, well, the university student is kind of liminal, but not quite the same way in that. The college entrance examination, sometimes people will say, is very akin to the civil service examination. But that's not quite true either, in the sense that either college education has a very sort of prescribed and definite interval. We know that, well, for most people anyway, after 4 years or, you know, after however number of years, they will get a degree. There's a definite, more or less prescribed end to it. This interval that I'm talking about, in which someone is a candidate, aspirant, in Tang Chang'an, theoretically, there is no, or practically, there's no minimum or maximum length of time for that interval to play itself out. So someone could succeed on his first try, or as a case of many late Tang literati, they could be still trying in their 60s and 70s. And we have anecdotes that attest to that process. So there's this curious period that really defies sort of modern parallels, in which they are and they're not sanctioned by virtue of their learning. They may and may not participate in the workings of the empire. And so I think the multitude of names and descriptions that have congregated around this period is testament to how strange and also how fruitful that period is. So often we talk, during this time, people talk about Chengming. So to have established or completed one's name as a description for having, for passing the examinations. And there's also many other kinds of descriptions that mobilize Taoist, Buddhist images of crossing a threshold. So I talk about bianhua, this term for this really kind of catch-all term for transformation. I guess all of this is going to, toward your question of what does that mean? I guess the collective discourse is trying to understand through these different ways, through language, different kinds of language, exactly what this means. And we see this in as textual traces in narratives, in poems, in social poems, in letters and exchanges, in how people complain about their fate and how people celebrate their good fortune. This idea of Ming being this new coveted stage of life that really has no parallel before this time.
And this is, for me, one of the really one of many really fascinating things about what's happening in the book, and in this part of the book in particular, is I think we tend to, or I'll just speak for myself, right? As a reader, I tend to, when I think of a self and I think of an individual, I think of a unit, right, an object. And what this chapter is really doing is showing us how, based on your really incisive and creative and thoughtful readings of these narratives that come out of this process, the self here is constantly in transformation, right? It's a deeply transformative experience that is the experience of selfhood. And that's tied to, the name as a process, right? The name is kind of aspirational, right? It's a process of trying to get your name, to complete your name. Time is also changing, and experiences of time are changing in this period along the lines of this process. And you talk about this in the chapter, you call it an emerging chronotope, right? There's a sort of way of experiencing and thinking about time that's tied to the processes that you've talked about, but also the exam calendar and the way that that shapes the space of Chang'an. There's also, in terms of thinking about a self and the stories that make a self, there's a kind of narrative that comes out of this that you call the unbiography. Right, and trying to kind of, I think, emphasize for us the liminality of this self, the sort of non-linear aspect of the self, the meandering, without a singular destination way of thinking about this self. So what's an unbiography, Linda? Because that's an awesome term that I hope everyone who listens to this will use right now.
It's actually hard to come up with a term that really does justice to this, what I'm trying to articulate. So I settled on that really by lack of anything better. What I was trying to get at is that often when you read epitaphs that enumerate a life lived through the number of posts this person, the deceased, might have held, the year he receives his Jingshi degree is mentioned, and then the posts that come after that, and how and of course eventually chronologically goes to the point his last post, his where he lived just before he died. What's interesting, of course, all of those information is, and actually not just information, that forms of articulation are interesting. Sometimes we read between the lines, right? We have to think about what was not mentioned. And I think of I think of the unbiography as those gaps, those texts that the lines that are excised out of the first draft of the epitaph, right? Mm-hmm. That could not be mentioned or are just not the right form to be mentioned, and yet they are the meanderings and the stumbles that inform a lot of these narratives that I do spend time on in the book. And again, the tale of Liwa is an example of a story that would not make it to the epitaph, would never make it to the epitaph, should not make it to the epitaph, but doesn't go away just because it cannot be contained in that form. It's not going awayness plays itself out in these more marginal genres of writing, such as the anecdote and the xiaoshuo, the tang tale, so what I wanted to accomplish with this unbiography is to say, let us pay attention to the blank spaces, to the things that doesn't quite fit in the course of these literati lives.
And so much of the book draws our attention to those things that don't quite fit, right? I mean, you just were talking about meanderings and stumbles. And for me, one of the things that the book is very deeply about is about maybe changing our perception of Chang'an from this mappable, you know, imperially planned space where there's the walls and the grids and everything makes sense, to a city of meanderings and stumbles, right? I mean, it's very much the case, at least in my reading experience of the book, that it's the meanderings and the stumbles that make the city, that make the lived experience of the city. And we have that coming out in the next couple of chapters in really beautiful detail. So after, we haven't even talked about some of the fabulous stories that have already been mentioned in chapter one that we haven't talked about. So mentioned for listeners, there's this fabulous story of this guy who, like, you know, eats and eats and eats, and he's just got skinnier and skinnier. And it turns out, like, you know, a bunch of foreigners, and then they're called foreigners, right, come to him, and they're like, oh, you've got this, like, weird monster creature, and you vomit it up, and we'll give you lots of money. And he does, and the creature, and they boil the creature, but the creature doesn't die, and these immortals come, and they're like pearls. Anyway, it's fabulous. It's in chapter one. Go read it. The story of Lu Yong and the flower devouring crawler, and we could spend the rest of the hour talking just about that. Because
yes,
it's fabulous. But we won't. We will move on to travel.
Okay,
so meanderings and stumbles. So as we move into the next couple of chapters of the book, we move into chapters that look at kind of meanderings through the city. So the second chapter takes us into a kind of exploration of the ways that travel to and from Chang'an become routine, right, in the Tang, again, because of this larger examination system, and the city itself changes. And as a result of this, their, like, literati relationships with the city and with themselves also change. Now, you talk here about, again, to kind of emphasize the non-linearity of the city, the non-linearity of the development of selves, the non-linearity of these travels, you emphasize the importance of the peripheral, right, subsidiary journeys that come from and come along with the seemingly simple, straightforward journey to the capital. Can you talk about the importance of this, these kind of subsidiary journeys to the periphery that come out of narratives in this chapter?
Absolutely. So as we've mentioned, this annually held examination in the capital itself is something that has generated, it has become this engine for routinized travel, but I don't want to give the impression that that it's a kind of routinized travel that goes from point A to point B, where point A is home province of a candidate, and then point B is Chang'an. And even though there are, as I mentioned, because the interval of success, the time before success, the number of years it takes to attain a degree is indeterminate. There are many repeated journeys. It's not a singular straight arrow to the capital and back. And actually, the flower addict story that you just mentioned actually, even though this is not in chapter two, it's actually a way that we can say it is an embodiment of these peripheral subsidiary journeys that you were asking about, in the sense that a lot of these stories are not about, unlike the Tale of Liu Hua, a lot of these stories are not about this delayed success story. They are more complicated than success stories, or they're alternative success stories, or sometimes they're outright failure, stories of failure. So what I wanted to show the reader is that sometimes it takes a journey into Chang'an for a candidate or aspirant to get out of Chang'an. In this case, the flower addict, by virtue of being in Chang'an in this cosmopolitan space, discovers something else about himself that is not quite the kind of talent that the examination system is vetting for. He discovers there's a resource. This is a very strange story, but it's a resource through this parasite that has claimed his stomach for years, that he had by virtue of this coming to into the acquaintance of these foreigners. They're called Hu, Huren. It propels him onto actually a journey to the very edge of the empire, which is it's not explicitly named, but it's somewhere on the south coast of China. So basically, it propels him onto this sea journey. That then becomes the place where he finds an alternative livelihood that circumvents this examination system altogether. So Chang'an plays, ironically, by being the center of recruitment for talent, this whole tournament for talent, as Ben Elman calls it, it also becomes this kind of launch pad for alternative unimagined other livelihoods for candidates and aspirants. And I find that really interesting, as just almost more interesting than its role in the examination system. Just by virtue of, it's not centripetal in that it's center seeking, but it's also centrifugal. It goes outside, toward the edge.
That's right. And the next chapter actually does this, or takes us into this process even deeper, right? I mean, not as deep as into the ocean where we go with the flower. I mean, really, listeners, you have to read this. I mean, just to, I digress, but I have to digress. They're at the ocean, and they're, refining this creature that this guy has just vomited up, that he's made like billions of dollars from, and the foreigners are refining it, and then the guy's looking at the ocean, and these strange, wondrous beings are coming out of the ocean with these plates of jewels, and the foreigners are like, ah, don't worry about it, just ignore it. He's like, what? Like, why are you? Then anyway, so I won't give away the end of the story, but listeners will get their book and read it. It's fabulous. So as we move into the next chapter, you bring us into spaces in Chang'an that are where boundaries are being crossed, walls are being traversed, hierarchies are being leveled. In some of these spaces, we have practices of disguise, a of roguery, of deception, which include not just the emperor disguising himself as just kind of a common person and walking around, but we have someone disguising himself as the emperor disguising himself as a normal person. So there's all these layers, right, of transgression, and there's these layers of leveling of hierarchies. There's also a really interesting component to this chapter, though, where you bring us into a dimension of the city that for me was a really new way of thinking about and thinking with Chang'an, and that is the skyline. You bring our attention to the vertical dimension of Chang'an. So because for me, this was such an innovative, just really fabulous way of making the city come alive for us. Can you talk a little bit about the verticality here of Chang'an? For you, what's most interesting about this aspect of the sort of lived experience of the city?
Thank you for that, again, for that summary of, I've through the course of working on this, I've seen lots of different reconstructions of the shape of Chang'an, and some of the readers might have seen this also. It's variously called a tablet of chocolate or a chessboard. I like the tablet of chocolate reference better. And we see, and again, this is not trivial, of course, because archaeology has meticulously tried to give us the outlines of the palaces, the walls of the wards, and it takes a lot of effort for us to get to that point. The limit of that is, for better or for worse, is that this tablet of chocolate or this map of the reconstructed Chang'an is two-dimensional. It gives, we have the width and breadth, and unfortunately, not the third dimension. And so, I often found myself thinking, well, what if we were to sort of take this out of flatland? What happens? I found some ways, imperfectly, of course, but, some of the narratives, when read against the grain, can inform us as to at least how some of these writers envisioned the third dimension, the walls, the height of the Zen Pagoda in the southeast corner. The story that I mentioned in the very beginning of the conversation with the knight errant, the female knight errant, that sort of so kind of fascinated me years and years ago, involved this young woman who was who just decided to steal a merchant's rosary and decided to hide it on top of the Zen Pagoda, which is about 60 meters high. If we're going to talk about lived space, we have to talk about the walls and the verticality of how what one sees when she lifts her head up toward the top of the pagoda, and what happens when you kick a ball over a ward wall? Like, what do you do? And I hope other scholars will continue to think about this. This is only a very preliminary foray into this third dimension, but this is where I think the narratives actually really give us insights that that a plain map of reconstructed map of Chang'an cannot.
I love that section of the book so much, and it really does. I mean, in a way, you are doing what you're reminding us to look up, like figuratively and literally, and that's really, really helpful. And we need that reminder. Right. I mean, in general and specifically, we need to be reminded of that. And this is just a really beautiful, really helpful way of doing that in terms of how we understand lived space and how we understand these texts.
Yeah, and I want to add that it's this need for looking up is not just for us, you know, living in the 21st century with skyscrapers. I think we tend to underestimate the degree to which there's a height. There are skyscrapers in every era, right? It's only not in absolute terms, but for every dweller in Chang'an, there is something that is beyond reach in the third dimension, and how people deal with that, how they imaginatively and practically deal with that, is fascinating to me.
So you mentioned walls, right, as being an important part of this, and this, I think, takes us really nicely into the second chapter, or into the next chapter, right? The next chapter, chapter 4, Staging Talent in Urban Areas. Now, this is a chapter that looks at the importance for the man of letters that we've been looking at of demonstrating his talent in the public eye. And you look at what you call the theatricality of talent. Now, this chapter focuses on examination lore, and it shows us that the urban space of Chang'an is offering exam candidates opportunities to prove themselves out of the exam grounds, right? And what those outside spaces look like are very varied, but they include, among other things, writing on spaces that are not examination papers, writing on pagodas, writing on various kinds of materials, and writing on walls and doors. So because this is a really fascinating addition, I think, to the way we understand the materiality of writing, right? And you mentioned Chris Nugent's work. We talked, I think now some years ago, right? yes. But this is, I think, for me, a really exciting aspect of historical and literary studies of China and beyond that we really need to pay more attention to. So writing on walls, writing on doors, writing on pagodas, Linda, what is exciting for you about that in terms of the work that you're doing in this chapter?
So you mentioned Chris Nugent, and he was very, in his work, he had very powerfully demonstrated how alive, really the vitality of manuscript culture in terms of the circulation of poetry, that we don't really, you know, we living in the, you know, depending on, you know, how you think of it, either in the print world or in the post-codex world, sort of don't, we tend to forget or overlook. And so with this chapter, what I wanted to bring into the conversation is the fact that in addition to those circulated manuscripts, to those orally circulated songs and lines, there's this kind of world of graffiti, if you will, in Tang Chang'an that played a very important part in people's self, their own creation of their image, and also the modulation or the challenge to other people's creations of their images. Having a pagoda that could be written on, that was understood to be sort of the poster board for men of talent, invites these men of letters during this very liminal part of their lives, or sometimes even after that, to show the world, to show the urban world, the spectators, what they're capable of. And this showing, this presenting, has very important consequences, because among these spectators are potentially people who will be able to elevate you. And again, this is one of the peculiarities of Tang examination system, in the sense that it was much more open to influence by this, not just the examiner himself who makes these decisions, that there is this larger circle outside of the examiners who can influence his decision. And then beyond that circle, there's even a larger circle of sort of a popular sort of readership probably made up mostly of men of letters, but a larger set of them, who are able to propagate this kind of reputation. And this is a kind of poetic reputation that that could also sway the inner circles. So there's this really, really dynamic sort of set of concentric circles of spectators who are looking at the walls, looking for signs of wit or signs of poetic prowess, and then for them to defend themselves and each other. So this is why I say it's a spectator sport in some ways. And the sport takes place not just on paper, but also in these urban features, these blank spaces in the urban center, that also require people to look up. So
this is, you've brought us into the importance of spaces that we might not necessarily look to when we look to spaces of self-making for these literati, spaces of writing, right? Spaces of inscription. There's other spaces also that you bring us into toward the end of the book. Now, these are spaces that include some of the walls and some of the doors that the poems are being written on in chapter 4. And these are spaces of the pleasure quarters. Now, chapter 5 takes us into the pleasure quarters of Chang'an in Pingkang Ward, and it explores it as a site and opportunity for the transformation of literati, right? Now, this is based on a close reading of vignettes from anecdotes from the Northern Ward, and those anecdotes allow us to see otherwise invisible flows of information, flows of desire, and flows of resources in the urban space of Chang'an. This is a totally fascinating chapter, and like the other chapters, we could speak about it for easily another hour. So I just want to mark this, especially for listeners. Now, you're showing in this chapter, among other things, as you put it in this chapter, that in the Northern Ward, not just the literati mattered, but the courtesans really mattered. The lived spaces that they created and dwelt in really mattered, and the cost of the entertainments that were enjoyed by them and by the literati really mattered. You talk here about the ways that these different matters, right, and forms of mattering are bound up with a discourse of romance. And the chapter takes us into the kind of identities that are formed according to relations of romance, the temporalities of this romance, and also some of the values that are created by and that help form this discourse of romance. So there are three cases that you bring us into that sort of close the chapter that talk about this sort of negotiation of value and values around romance. One case is a case of an elegant courtesan's posthumous disgrace, as you put it here. There's a thwarted marriage proposal that goes from the courtesan to the client. And there's also another story. This is a story that's really fascinating from the perspective of these flows and networks of information. And I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit about it, because the idea of locating and narrating and historicizing flows of information, right, into these sort of networks of news, networks of desire, channels and flows, very much hooks this story and what you're doing here up with, I think, a larger interest in the history and literature of itinerancy and flows and circulation and information in the sort of medieval and early modern period. So I think this is a story, and this is your analysis of this story in particular is potentially of really kind of wide-ranging import if we hook it up into that larger narrative. So the tale of Zhang Juju, Linda.
Okay.
The tale of Zhang Juju, and for you, what's important about this tale in this larger context?
Okay, so just briefly, the tale of Zhang Juju is one of the sort of more marginal stories in this larger collection of courtesan quarter anecdotes about courtesans, and. But before I get into the sort of the nitty gritties. The story is doing for me is to show it shows me anew that to talk about Chang'an, to talk about these groups of people who lived here, is kind of it. You can think of, you know, my book is a attempt to try to capture different forms of mobility that happen to converge at a certain point in space. In this case, in Chang'an at large, and then in this chapter, in this ward or residential enclosure in particular. And so, not a lot of stories are so sort of scintillating with resources that demonstrate these kinds of mobilities. The story of Zhang Zhuzhu is one in sort of in the very sort of the soundbite summary is that it's a courtesan in the pleasure quarters who by a series of very clever maneuvers, manages to marry her childhood sweetheart by leveraging the patronage of a wealthy client who is not a literatus, by the way, who is a wealthy client, a merchant in the Ping Kong ward. But this is a story that's told from a perspective of the author of the collection, who is a literatus, who is an official. Sun Qi. So we have multiple kinds of attachments. We have a literatus, a highly placed literatus who is telling the story of the cleverness of a Ping Kong courtesan who manages to, in a way, find a romance outside of her profession. So what I was trying to say with this story is that it tells us a lot about the kind of people who live there, who are not ordinarily what you expect to be characters or features in literatus anecdotes. And this is a particularly valuable glimpse for that reason into a larger set of sociality that's playing out in this very, by now we're talking about a city within a city, right? The city within a city, who are the players, what are the stakes, and how much it costs.
Mm-hmm. And so what are these flows of information? Like, how do we understand, like, what's going on with that part of the story? Because it seems like, you know, there are a number of people right now who are getting interested in a histories of and with news and histories mm-hmm. of and with information. So how does this story speak to, you know, where's the information here, and how might that speak to this larger conversation about flows of information and the kinds of sources that historians and literary scholars might look to in order to locate and understand historical flows of information?
Yeah, so just coming out of so the previous chapter was dealing with how literati manage their sort of literary reputation by writing the right kinds of verse at the right place, or to one up someone else by writing witty commentary on someone else's writing. And so here in the Ping Kong War, what we see is that this was not the exclusive venue for literati, for the male literati. The courtesans themselves were actively doing this too. So in the case of Zhang Zhuzhu, what the heart of the story revolves around these alleyway ditties, these ditties that little children or some kind of youngsters, they're not really described very in detail, but there's this scattered band of roving children or adolescent who sing or chant ditties that contain crucial information about, in this case, who was sleeping with whom, or who was actually pulling the wool over someone else's eyes. So the crucial exchange in this case first exposes the courtesan Zhuzhu as basically being unfaithful to the client. That the wealthy merchant who had wanted to become his concubine. So it's the alleyway band of ditty chanters who first exposes this, and then the courtesan, along with her lover and also with her her household, manages to devise a way to change the ditty in a minimal way to be chanted back, that then says, oh, actually, no, this is not really the story, and revises the information contained in the first ditty. So what we see is this media machine being played out by very, very knowing participants who understood that information or reputation is not necessarily only on paper, even on walls. They are resident in the rhymes of the alleyway bands of roving children, and that they were, you know, their success, which is analogous to the success that literati men were cultivating in themselves, is to form the ultimate language, to rally the ultimate kind of language to describe themselves, to put themselves in the best light. And so to see it taking place, to see it unfold in the very specific alleyway, to have it unfold in the mouth of people rather than on, you know, as, you know, pen, you know, brush and ink, is really fascinating.
So what this actually brings us to, you know, toward our conclusion, and it also brings us to something that I just want to make sure that I mention that I really loved about the book, because it's, you know, you mentioned at the very beginning, and we've talked about this a little bit, how deeply the book is engaging with a really fundamentally interdisciplinary range of sources and range of ideas in manifesting its narrative and its story. But one of the things that I hope is clear to listeners, and that's certainly clear to me at this point in our conversation, is how much the book is speaking back in a similarly interdisciplinary way. I mean, we've just heard, even just in this, you know, single story, and we just, you know, talked about a couple of the many, many stories in the book, the ways in which a really unusual kind of source, you know, a source from anecdotes from the Northern Ward about Tang China, can speak to media studies, can help us understand a media machine, thanks to alleyway bands of ditty chanters, right? And can speak to information flows and histories of mobility. It's just a really imaginative way of reading sources, Linda, that helps the book also speak out and contribute interdisciplinarily just as much as it's, I think, gaining from its interdisciplinary source base. So thank you for that. And I really appreciate that about the book. And I think it's important to say that.
Oh, thank you so much.
So as we get to the epilogue, there's a brief epilogue in the book, and we don't have a whole lot of time to go into it in detail, but the epilogue does gesture out into some of the ways that the story changes after the Tang, right? In ways that might help us understand what's so distinctive about the period that we've just looked at in understanding Chang'an as a city of lived spaces. For you, are there any particular aspects of that brief discussion of what happens afterwards that you'd like to mention for listeners, and that's important for you that listeners understand?
It is a very brief epilogue, and I think it's brief because I could, by this point, I feel like I can turn over the burden, or maybe not burden, but the task of thinking about cities and mobilities to a large number of very active and very excellent scholars who are working in the Song and then in the later imperial eras that have and there have been wonderful flurry of books that have come out about cities after the Tang. And so I feel like the readers are in good hands after this point, because scholars are actively thinking about the different sources that are available for, you know, Song Dynasty Kaifeng, for Luoyang, for cities like Nanjing. So there's a wonderful horizon that opens up. I would say for the Tang, there's a challenge in the sense that there are not the same kinds and the same number, quantity of sources that I feel very envious of scholars working with later imperial cities for the range of sources they have. And so what my strategy has been with this book to just try to get the most out of the sources that we have and to do as much as we can and not think about what isn't there. I mean, we think about it, but not to sort of mourn it too much.
Well, and there's a lot that is there, Linda, and there's a whole lot more that's there in the book than we had time to talk about, right? So there's a million, billion, gazillion things that we could have talked about that we didn't have a chance to get to. And I hope that listeners, having had a taste, right, of some of the exciting things from this conversation, will turn themselves to the book and find all the other juicy fabulousness that's there. In the meantime, is there anything in particular that you'd like to mention for listeners that we didn't actually have a chance to talk about? That is important for you to let them know.
Nothing specific, but I'll just mention that one thing that has been really fun about working, so kind of continuing what I just said, not to be too envious of other of scholars working in other cities, one thing that I really enjoyed is working with a period or working with terminologies that are still very vague. a lot of things that have shown up in my book requires explanations about the incompleteness or instability of the terminology. So even with the word narrative, with the word tales or 小说 in Chinese, or 传奇, or the set of texts that's translated as transmissions of the marvelous, we work with a lot of terminologies that require a lot of explanations. And the reason that they require explanations is that they were in flux. They were actively sort of sometimes misused in the sense that they were used in ways that are not stable. And to me, even though this is a nightmare, even though this is a challenge, one thing that I really, that also perversely draws me to this set of sort of cultural practices that don't have really good names, is that they're in flux. They're alive in a way that that really invites us to participate in this process of coming to terms with them. The reader might encounter a lot of terms where they're called by different names, and they're imprecise, indecisive, or maybe some readers might wonder, really? But I think this is part of the magic of working in this period, is this vitality that comes from a collective imagination that's still trying to accrete around something that was fairly new.
So now that the book is out, and congratulations.
Thank you.
What's next for you? What are you currently being inspired by, and what are you currently working on?
Yeah. Thank you for asking that. I started really get into maps lately. And it's partially because in looking for, back when I was looking for a cover image for this book, I was wrestling with the lack of maps in the town. That got me thinking about what it means to think about spatial knowledge during a time when almost no maps survive. So I'm working on trying to understand writing about maps, about thinking maplessly about maps during the Tang, but also as a larger project about the development of spatial knowledge during this time, during late medieval China. Not in terms of maps, but in other kinds of cultural technologies. So, so that's been fun.
Well, best of luck, Linda, with that project, and I will check back in with you when that's done, and we'll talk again.
Thank you. Thank you.
Standing offer. We'll have a date in the future. Thank you so much. It's really been a pleasure, and just thanks for giving us a book that's so wonderful, and thanks for giving me an hour of your time, Linda.
Thank you for this wonderful conversation.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.